All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are live. Welcome everybody to episode 36 of Logos Academy. This has been a long-awaited one. I know many people are excited for this one. We're joined by none other than David Duke today. I do apologize we're a little bit late because we had some technological problems on our end with the camera and everything, but we're good to go now. Duke, how are you? It's nice to have you on.
Just fine. It's probably all my fault, being that I'm a boomer.
That's all right. Like I said, I'm young, but I'm just as bad with technology, so we can't blame it on age here.
I've been pretty good with computers. I've always been doing it, and I've done thousands of podcasts and so forth. Usually we don't have these problems, but we had a funny situation where a program has come up hijacking the camera, so we think we got that straight.
Okay, good. It's good to have it all set up now. So, for starters, I just kind of want to get the audience acquainted with you. I'm sure most people are familiar with you. You're a very prominent figure publicly. However, just maybe some background on yourself, because you have a very extensive history in politics and in, I guess we could say philosophy as well. So, if you maybe want to tell the audience how you started getting into politics and kind of what gave you that interest.
Well, I guess I can first just start off with my educational background and where I'm from and so forth, and a little bit of my political history, a little bit of my academic history. Okay. I'm actually was born in Oklahoma, but I lived most of my life in Louisiana. I did go to kindergarten in Holland. My dad worked for Shell Oil. And just so people get a framework of my family, it's kind of interesting because my family was very educated family. My father was a geologist, a petroleum engineer, and from early time, he's very scientific minded and conservative. He was also a full colonel in the military, so we had some distinguished military people in my ancestry. And he was also a strong Christian, taught Sunday school. We always used to go to different churches, so we weren't too biased about. He used to tell me and tell the family that he just wants to go to where he likes the preacher the most that's more in line with his viewpoints.
That's good.
And he was in the war. Interestingly enough, a little anecdote, he in the beginning of the Second World War, he was a young officer, and he was the courier that brought Eisenhower. Eisenhower was on in during maneuvers in Fort Polk, Louisiana, and which is interesting because I was in ROTC when I was in at LSU, and they have a large ROTC class, Reserve Officer Training Program, and I was also in the Special Forces kind of ROTC group. We used to go train with the Special Forces during my first couple of years of college in the basic program over at Fort Polk, and my father, during the war, brought Eisenhower his orders to go to Europe, believe it or not. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
But my father was pretty aware. He was fairly conservative. He was very open-minded about everything. In fact, I remember he gave me a book called The Final Secret of Pearl Harbor when I was a young kid. And which was written by, I think, two Admiral Kimmel and another admiral from Pearl Harbor, which was all about how the U.S. government broke the Japanese code. And so the Roosevelt administration knew the Japanese were going to attack Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And they purposely did not inform the commanders at Pearl Harbor. And they proved that. They showed that in the book, the evidence. But they did break the Japanese secret code. And so I guess Roosevelt wanted an incident to get us into the war to justify it.
Absolutely.
It was always called the back door to war. And I must say that talking about these things is kind of interesting because they were trying to goad the Germans into war by doing a lot of things. But my dad, also after working for Shell, and he was a home builder and he had a number of different businesses, he ended up going to Vietnam. And working with USAID, not as an army officer, he was a full colonel in the reserve, and helping the anti-communist war effort in Vietnam. And interestingly enough, he was very on a communist, but he wasn't quite. Of course, he had the typical theory and in the feeling that, oh, Hitler had to be stopped. Of course, back then you just didn't have alternative media. And the truth is, and I hope your listeners know, I think they probably do. I heard some of your broadcasts, which were very erudite and very intelligent. And the truth is, one of the greatest tragedy in the history of European mankind was the Second World War and the First World War.
Yeah.
And he didn't understand that then, but ultimately his son did. I read a lot. He used to sit me down and read my family. His mother, by the way, was a chemistry professor at KU.
Okay.
But she was no feminist. In fact, believe it or not, this is all a fact. She was a human rights worker for immigrants in Chicago, but this is back in 1920. Now, those immigrants then were Scandinavians mainly, right. Norwegians. And they worked for these Jewish meatpacking firms in Chicago, and they treated these people like dogs.
Shocking.
I think they treated these Scandinavian people who were immigrants, had the dream of coming to America, like worse than I think blacks were treated in slavery in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And she helped them. And one of the interesting things about her, she was she supported the 1924 Immigration Restriction Act. She also believed in a principle of eugenics. And this wasn't a eugenics like the way the media portrays it, of trying to sterilize people. It was more of a positive eugenics, but she really, even though I had no idea of this until I knew some of it. Her sister was my grandmother, Florence Hedger, my grandfather and her, of course, and she was at KU. My father later was in the military, and he went to KU, and the interesting fact is that my great aunt, okay, that's who my grandmother's sister was. So my great aunt actually was also part of the American Eugenics Society.
Interesting.
And my great aunt again was a restrictionist immigrationist. And I have a very fine genealogist, a really great genealogist. And she dug up all these papers and everything. She was very, very one of the most famous doctors. In fact, she was commissioned. This is my Aunt Carolyn Hedger. And my grandmother actually died of cancer, probably from the chemistry. She helped write textbooks, and probably the chemicals got her. But my aunt was a very famous doctor, lectured the country, and used to be sponsored these Better Babies contests.
Okay.
And trying to encourage real good health among kids and healthy diet. She was also really kind of a natural food kind of person, which is basically what I am too. And, you know, natural foods, meat, air, sunshine,
good.
all that kind
way.
Of stuff. And doesn't fall far from the tree, does it? And she amazingly, she was expert in also stopping disease spread and so forth. And during the First World War, they brought her to Belgium early on in the war to help stop the typhus and other epidemics, their cholera epidemics and so forth they were having in Belgium. She got medals from the government by helping to stem that.
Wow.
But the interesting thing is, for years, she lectured at universities all over the country, just like I have. I've lectured at 200 universities in my life. So you got a little bit of my background there. But she actually went to these universities, and there's many different headlines I can read. It can tell you. She often had so many people come out to hear her on these subjects that she had to do two lectures in a row with 1,000, 1,500 people. She was pretty famous. That was long before women's liberation, and she herself wasn't a women's liberationist. She was a traditional person. And so the headline, this is really interesting. Now, this is in the 1920s. The headline from the Omaha newspaper, where she's there to give a lecture, and she was again living in Chicago, and was Carolyn Hedger says abortion, right? Abortion is birth control and abortion is a menace to the race.
I would read that. It's a good statement.
That was pretty prophetic.
Absolutely.
So sometimes, you know, and I didn't know these kind of details about my great aunt. I knew a lot about my grandmother and her co-authoring some chemistry books and so forth. And she died of cancer probably because of the chemicals that she was dealing with. She wasn't a Madame Curie, but she was great, a good chemist. And so that's just part of my family. And but I came from a very strong educational background and scholarly background. And so my parents had me reading from the time I was about three. And they used to sit me in this red rocker and they'd give me things to read. And after, you know, you first you kind of fight it, but then you go along with it. And then I just gobbled up every book you could think of. By the time I was 9, 10 years old, I was subscribing to Scientific American, reading it from cover to cover.
Nice.
Every month, and I understood it all, and I was just learning a lot of things, and I was becoming somewhat in my politics a little liberal, because that's what I was reading so much of in terms of the mainstream media. And when I was in junior high school, I had to do a paper on, and this is the time of integration. This is maybe 1962, 63. And integration was a big thing in New Orleans. At that time, the Times-Picayune, this is before it was Jewish bought, because it was taken by this Jewish firm we call it's called the Newhouse family. We used to call it the Jewhouse family. And so the original paper in New Orleans was the conservative paper that said that destroying the schools of New Orleans with this forced integration was going to damage education in New Orleans. It was going to damage both the lives of black people and white people. Was not going to help situations and really bring peace or justice to either race. There's nothing wrong with having schools oriented toward black needs and white schools, you know, oriented toward white needs, because right. The races had different issues and different questions and different issues. Today, blacks are kind of supporting that. W. Du Bois, who was actually became kind of a communist, he first associated with the NAACP, and then later in his life, he found that he agreed more with Marcus Garvey, who was a separationist and wanted to go back to Africa, right. Who was, by the way, set up and framed by Jews. The people that put him in prison were all Jews.
Not surprising at all.
No, not surprising. So he worked with the NAACP, which is a really Jewish organization. And in the 1920s and 30s, he split with them. And this was the most famous, he was a very intellectual person. He was the most famous black person in the NAACP, which was led mostly by Jews. It was all totally financed by Jews, Jewish communists.
Right? Yeah, yeah. Stephen Wise and the crew.
Oh, yeah, there's so many of them. But he later came to believe that the answer to solving the black people's problems is not integration per se, but black empowerment, you know, kind of to orient schools for them. The programs, even George Washington Carver, Jeff, so many other of the black enlightenment, you know, the black leaders, black universities, this kind of thing. And that's kind of interesting itself, that he ended up breaking from the NAACP, because the NAACP was about integration. And anyway, I learned... In school, I had a wonderful civics teacher in ninth grade who assigned us all to do a paper on something that interests them in the political sphere, the political subject. And at that time, I was pretty favorable toward integration. This is before I learned about Boas and before I learned about the Jewish role in any of this stuff. Very young. I learned about the Jewish question 13, 14. And I've been knowing about it ever since. So they said, what do you want like to do a paper? So I was interested on why integration, you know, the case for racial integration. Now, this is kind of unbelievable. It's strange I thought this way then, but I read a lot. And boy, the propaganda was big. The first book I read on the race question specifically was Ashley Montague's book called The Myth of Race. Ashley Montague was a famous anthropologist promoted by the media at the time. And interestingly enough, his real name, Ashley Montague, that's a very English name. It's like English aristocratic name.
Certainly.
In reality, Ashley Montague's real name was Israel Ehrenberg.
Nice.
Yeah, I wonder why he changed his name. But anyway, and of course he argued that race was a myth. But when the teacher was very wise woman, and she, it was Mrs. Dismix was her name, and she so when all the kids wrote, said, "Well, I want you to write down the you, I want you to take a position on a political event, and then pass it in." She passed it in, and passed in the copy. And then the teacher, when it's all passed in, and then she sent it back to them, or she wrote it down, and then so she said to them, "Okay, see, this is the time when you're going to learn how to think, and you're going to learn how to examine things scientifically and think empirically in terms of Western thought patterns." She says, "So, whatever subject you wrote, whatever case you're going to write for, switch it around.
Okay.
I want you to do the opposite case." So, if someone wrote that we should get into the Vietnam War, people then had to write we should stay out of the Vietnam War, whatever issue they talked about. If somebody talked about zero population growth, which was another Jewish feature, Ehrlich was the guy that wrote that, the population bomb, and which they were trying to get white people not to have kids, because it's only intelligent people, by the way, they're not going to have kids,
Of course.
because they're going to be the ones that are going to come read that book, But but the interesting thing was that, so I had to switch around the case against integration. And when I started looking around on that subject, I was kind of shocked, because even though we had pretty good library in the book, every book that I dug up, and this was a Christian school, by the way. It was actually run by the Church of Christ at that time. But even the stuff in the library was all supporting integration. And I went down and finally, I went downtown and went to Doubleday. Every single book on the shelf was saying integration was going to be a great thing. It was going to help education. It was going to solve the anger and the hatred between the races. It was going to bring peace, love, brotherhood. It was going to raise black people up and solve the poverty problem and everything, and help them really perform. So that's interesting. So, but I couldn't find any books on this. So finally, I heard about the Citizens Council, which is a big group at that point. And so I called them up on the phone, went down there, and I said, "Do you have any books that's opposed to the integration issue by scholars, scientists, whoever?" And they said, "We got lots of them. Come on down. You can get one." So I went down after school. My dad worked at Shell, by the way, in New Orleans at that time. And I walk into the Citizens Council office. They had bookcases as high as my ceiling, about 8 feet, 9 feet. And the books were nothing but books by scientists, educators, historians, saying that integration was not really going to help the well-being of black people, that the war on poverty was actually going to destroy the black family, because welfare was black. There wasn't much welfare at that time. There was some public housing, but the war on poverty was a $22 trillion program. And they argued that the welfare system would ultimately destroy the black family, and that would damage black people more than anything else. You can't damage black people more than making sure that kids don't grow up with a loving, present father.
Course.
And you have mothers that are having whatever, how many kids they ever want to have, right? And then they're not giving the kids what they need. And boys, blacks were about 5% at that point of the population, black males, 10% overall. And young males were 5%. And even back then, they weren't committing the kind of crime they were committing in the later 60s and 70s, but they were committing about half of the murders. And a lot of the murders were among black people. And so anyway, I found a book by Mr. Putman, and he wrote a book called Race and Reason. And I read this book and I was astounded. I just was astounded, because the evidence seemed to be so clear that there were differences in race, and that races had certain issues, and that forced integration of races wasn't necessarily going to bring about peace, love, and brotherhood.
No, it's
Even
quite
though
the opposite.
even though I was for peace, love, and brotherhood, right? And I still am for peace, love, and brotherhood. I'm for people not fighting one another, trying to kill one another. I'm very anti-war these days. Oh, did we lose connection?
No, I still got you on my end.
It was my monitor, I guess. I don't know what happened there. It's really crazy. Just a second. But you're still on there. Okay, I'm back. So, and the interesting thing was that Colton Putman, he was a historian. He was also head of Delta Airlines. And he wrote that integration is going to be a disaster for American education. And it was in many parts of the country, especially the South. And so in the process, he started mentioning a few names. He mentioned the fact that Ashley Montague was real name Israel Ehrenberg, right? And anyway, so I started studying and I began to start to learn about what was happening. But anyway, that was the beginning of my so-called awakening. Okay. And within about 2 years, I was just totally awakened to the fact that races are different. I didn't really have any hatred toward blacks. We had blacks in our New Orleans was a very integrated society, by the way, believe it or not, back then. It wasn't like some of the northern neighborhoods where you had the really clear delineation of the white area and the black area. Right. And there were blacks that we knew. I always treated people decently. But I came to believe that there was a plan in place, and it was an open plan to change the demographics of America, to literally make the European American population in this country a minority, which seemed totally crazy then. I mean, this is 1960. In the entirety of the 20th century, whites were about 90% of the population, almost 90, not quite 90, but close to it.
Right.
90%. When I went to LSU first year, LSU was all white at the time. We had white university, but we had a black university right down the block. It was almost as big as LSU, and yet there were 1/3 of the population was black, but a university directed and for black people. And I went to LSU. It was an all-white university. The football team was all white, believe it or not, back then. And they did pretty well at football every year. Nice. Half the guys in the team were – I played football earlier years, but were good friends of mine. And so then I started to realize that there was really a plan to make white people a minority in this country, and not stop there. They weren't going to relent until they basically destroyed us. I mean, made us a small minority, completely outnumbered and outvoted in our own country. And to what purpose was that? I mean, what was going on here? And then I began to realize, I started really reading deeply in these subjects, and I began to realize that the Jewish elite was dedicated. They felt themselves, first of all, let's put it this way. I began to learn that the most ethnocentric, that's maybe the best way to put it, the most ethnocentric, racist, supremacist people on this planet, and it's been that way for a couple thousand years, actually since they codified the Septuagint, the Old Testament, and Judaism became very radicalized from the Hasmonean dynasty. I don't want to get too complicated with all these academic things. I think you have an intelligent, very intelligent audience. I heard you talking about different aspects on some of these issues and the genetic difference in Jews. And so I've been really studying this a lot recently, too, because it's very interesting stuff, that Judaism was like the ultimate program of race. In fact, I would say that Judaism, and people often want to say Judaism is great, it's Zionism that's no good. Judaism is wonderful.
That's a very common subversion tactic that we get today. I'm constantly arguing that out of people.
It's ridiculous. Because, I mean, even the old, what we call the Old Testament. Now, the Old Testament, and this is the thing, I'll just tell you this. I mean, I am a Christian. I consider myself a Christian. I like the Christian faith. I like the teachings of Jesus. I really believe that we do need ideas like the Golden Rule. Now, the Golden Rule, or treating others as you treat yourself, are treating people with kindness and treating people and giving people a chance and not trying to cheat them, not trying to enslave them, not trying to hurt them. Be helpful where we can. But every people's got a right to preserve themselves. Right. So I began to realize fundamentally that I saw the fact that they were working. In fact, by the 1970s and 80s, Jewish publications were admitting that they wanted to make European Americans a minority. A good example is Perlmutter. Perlmutter was one of the heads of the ADL. They had the Perlmutter Institute in San Francisco. I have this in my book, My Awakening in Jewish Supremacism. And so they were writing. I said, we Jews have carefully calculated and produced a program and policies that will make sure that there's never, and they, everything, they always relate everything to Nazis.
Of course.
Because everything's related to anti-Semitism.
That has to be the center of morality in society, right? That has to be the ultimate evil.
Exactly. So they're right, you know, that that we can never, there never will be a Nazi government, because they call anybody that's white and wants to preserve their heritage a Nazi. They also call Palestinians Nazis. In fact, the truth is that Jews routinely, in the terms of, I'm talking about the Jewish intellectual elite and the Jewish religious elite, believe that all non-Jews are inherently, in their blood, in their genes, are inherently anti-Semitic, and it's for no reason.
Yeah, it's a virus. It's a mind virus, right? Of course,
something like that. So, I'll give an example. You could pull it. Do you ever pull up articles and put it on the screen? Can you do that?
It's hard on Rumble Studio. On like when I do like single shows, I do it, but it's hard to do when I'm doing like an interview format.
Well, there's an article I can just refer to it, but I think you can picture it. We've got an intelligent audience here. So, one of the biggest Jewish publications in the world is Times of Israel. It's one of the 10th largest publications in the world. And Times of Israel has an article by this fellow by the name of Michael Laitman, L-A-T. So people can look it up. You can write it down, folks at home. After this program, go read it. I mean, you'll be amazed, right? And it's called The New and the Old Anti-Semitism. And in this piece, he's saying that the non-Jewish population of the world are fundamentally all Nazis who want to kill Jews and kill Jewish children. I mean, he literally says this. They're just chomping at the bit to kill our kids, you know, to kill us, wipe us out on the planet. This is what he says.
It's a very schizophrenic worldview.
it's amazing. The entirety of humanity, right? And he goes to an example of why what I call this cognitive, talk about cognitive dissonance, it's cognitive just insanity. Because everything is like what the mainstream media tells you and what the Jewish establishment tells us is exactly the opposite of the reality, right?
Of course.
Because they'll tell you that the big danger to the world is European racism. And sometimes they even say, yeah, look at Israel. That's just nothing but white supremacy. White supremacy? You know, Jewish people have been dedicated to filled, and not saying all Jews, and again, there are some Jews I really respect. I love this guy, Jeffrey Sachs. He's great, man. He exposes the fact that the Iraq War was a Jewish war using our money, costing us $8 trillion in Iraq, right? He exposes the fact that the same people that gave us the Iraq War are the same people that gave us the Ukraine War that's caused the death of 1.2 million Ukrainians. That's the official kind of the accepted figures by the people who studied it now. The Ukraine war is not about saving Ukraine. It's about putting people that Jews hate, and they hate Ukrainians, and they hate Russians.
Of course.
They consider them, you know, the ultimate white anti-Semites, both of them. It's not about Ukraine. It's about hurting Russia, which they think is their biggest competitor, because the Russians under Putin dared to overthrow the Jewish power and overthrow the communist regime. I mean, they even foster the idea from people that Russia is still communist. You know, Russia, when it was a Soviet Union, led by Jews, did want to conquer the world. And those Jews, the Communist International, openly stated that their ultimate goal was the complete conquering of the world. And even Winston Churchill, in his article called Zionism versus Bolshevism. I'm throwing a lot of things at you here, but this is interesting, I think. In his article, he says that, you know, he points out that all the major leaders of communism, including the inner circle of the Communist Party in Russia, we're talking about Trotsky, you know, and all these different people, that it was overwhelmingly Jews. Kamenev, I mean, we just keep, I can give you a lot of names.
Luxembourg, Goldman, I'm very familiar with the article.
He said the Jews had gripped the Russian people by the hair of their heads and become practically undisputed masters of this enormous empire. And you know what? Jews knew this.
Of course.
And just about everybody knew it. The British knew it. The British British intelligence and what we call Scotland House, Scotland Yard, and later British intelligence, but sent out a letter to every country of the world and saying, the first part of this letter, every major nation of the world is saying, there's now definite evidence that Bolshevism is an international movement controlled by Jews. That's what it said. Churchill talked about this in his article. Now I'm going to give you some more interesting things about Churchill, because he ended up being an asset for the Jews.
Of course.
Now his chief biographer was, by the way, another Jew by the name of Martin Gilbert. And the Jews wheedled their way in, and they made sure they had a Jewish biographer who was the official biographer with the church, who was knighted by the government. The Jews have been corrupting the British government for years.
Yeah.
Just to give you a small example, because I like to always give a little example so people really realize I'm not talking out my butt. You know, I'm talking about something real. And a perfect example is that the Sassoons ran something called the dope trade, the opium trade,
yeah,
into China. And the Sassoons bribed the crown to let these Jews grow opium in India. They didn't want it to be consumed by India because the British had too much presence there. But they let them grow the opium in India, ship it to China, and then the Sassoons were addicting millions of Chinese people. And a lot of these were middle class, or what there was in China, and upper middle class, because they're the ones that had the money to get hooked and lose their fortunes as when they become drug heads, right?
Right.
And in China, they destroyed the lives of millions of Chinese. And they even had Britain go to war to protect the opium slave trade, the opium business, which was destroying so many millions of Chinese. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, right? And in fact, back then, it was called exactly what it was. The British wars in China, they had basically two periods, maybe three periods of this war. You know what it was called? The Opium Wars.
Of course.
And it was wars to send British soldiers into battle in China to make sure these Jews could destroy the lives of millions of really some of the best of the Chinese. Isn't that interesting? And of course, this is one of the reasons why you had the rise of people like Mao Zedong. And by the way, communism was also spread by Jews. In fact, anybody can Google right now, I can prove everything I say in about 3 minutes for people. They just look into it. Just go to your Google and just type in the Jews who brought communism to China. And they have whole websites done by Jews boasting about the fact that these Jews brought communism to China.
Yeah, there was quite a few of them behind Mao directly.
Directly, right?
Yeah. So, I just want to really quick back up on a point.
We're just flying all over the place. But
yeah.
That's fine.
Well, I want to touch on that point that you had mentioned actually before the show on the phone when you mentioned Jews as this being a genetic problem, because as you said earlier, you know, there's a lot of people that want to blame what's going on in Israel or in America on Zionism, or, you know, they like to go into these communism theories and things like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we know, historically, these people were kicked out of countries before they were Zionists, before they were communists, you know, before any of these political ideologies spawned. And then you have other people that want to blame it on maybe a religious aspect. But, you know, there very much is something to be said about religion being a product of race, right? Religion is a culture, and it comes mm-hmm. from a racial people. That's why you have these kind of five like monolith religions amongst all of the different races. So I'm very curious to maybe get your take on this as a genetic issue, looking at this from a genetic lens or a racial lens, when it comes to the Jewish problem and how they feel about, we'll just say white Europeans very broadly, and then collective Gentiles as well.
Well, okay. I definitely, this is one of the main themes I talk about, but I want to state from the outset, it's not just a genetic problem. It is a ideological problem. It is an organizational problem. And basically, as I said earlier, and this maybe sounds strange to people, but there is no people on planet Earth that are more concerned about their genealogy, about their interests. There's 52 major Jewish organizations in the United States of America. And you have the American, you know, so many of them. The World Jewish Congress, you have there's so many, I can't even name. You got AIPAC, you got all these things. But there are 52 organizations. According to the Ford, which is one of their leading publications in America, their advocacy, what they spend on promoting Jewish interests, and all these organizations and their mission statement say they're fighting for the Jewish people, and they're fighting for the Jewish people exclusively. They're trying to make sure the Jewish people are best off in education, they're best off in their economy, most often influenced, they're affecting foreign policy, they're restricting any rise of anti-Semitism, and that's supposed to be the biggest problem in the world. You know, you don't have to worry about any sort of anti except anti-Semitism. But this is what they say, and this is what they do. And they preach a doctrine of racial supremacism, and even a more powerful kind of supremacism. That's a supremacism decreed by, quote, God. See, it's one thing to say somebody is superior or better. I mean, black people pretty much think that blacks are the best at basketball, even though there are some whites that are pretty damn good. Pete Maravich played at my school at LSU. I saw him play many times, and nobody ever scored like he did, and that was before the 3 points things, and most of his shots for more than the feet thing for the 3 points, right? But the point is that, you know, everybody tends to favor their own, and that's kind of normal and natural.
Of course.
But the interesting thing is that Jews do say that in terms of, in fact, the way that a lot of the Jewish leaders of, and I'm talking about Judaism, put it. In fact, a good example is the Great Rebbe. That's who Trump's daughter is married to, and they go worship at the tomb of the Great Rebbe, right? He said the difference between Jews and Gentiles is a difference between what you call humans and animals. Is that much difference? It's in physical difference. It's a difference in every aspect, and that's pretty shocking. Also, they say that Jews are smarter. And I'm going to maybe offer some ideas later in this talk and this discussion that there's a lot of evidence that they're not smarter. Yeah. There is evidence that they're more racist. There is evidence that they fight by different standards and different structures than they tell us to fight by. They tell us to be fair-minded and not have a team effort. That's evil. That's kind of racist. Well, everything about Jews is about a team effort.
Right, and that's kind of the biggest problem with the circumstance that we're in today is that there's this very clear the only group of people that can't advocate for themselves is whites, right? That's the morally unacceptable one, and well, obviously you know that comes from Jewish literature. Meanwhile, right. Them advocating for themselves is completely morally upheld, and it's actually praised, right? It's praised by our politicians, our academics. It's pretty bad.
Well, and one of the principles, and it's not rocket science, it's not, you don't have to be the smartest people on earth to understand that if you're a small minority and you're fighting you're outnumbered by a very powerful elite of the opposition race or the opposition people in the country, and you want to get control of the country. I don't know why I keep losing connection here. Anyway, I'm back. So that if you do that, it makes sense to divide and conquer.
Right.
So it's not only just, you know, white people that they try to demean and they do try to demean and to change the demographic of the country. In fact, I try to explain this to the Palestinians and to the Arabs. And I've lectured at a number of universities. And by the way, I have a very different impression of Muslims than a lot of Europeans do and Americans do. I'm not in favor of Muslim immigration. And by the way, I'm a very honest and straightforward person about these kind of things. I've been invited to speak at, I spoke at universities in Libya before the fall. I was invited to Syria by the chief, you know, the mufti of the country, the top leading Muslim, who's, by the way, a very moderate Muslim, Sunni Muslim, who said he said publicly that he is against Sharia law. Because he says the truth is, if you have a country that's got all these Christians in it, you've got these other religious groups, and so it's really wrong to put one over the others. Now, if Muslims want to practice in those areas or countries where they're almost all the people, that's understandable. But so he's a very moderate kind of person. Syria was not a radical country. Right now, these Christians are being slaughtered, and I did a very emotional show last Friday because. The night before, in the middle of the night, I was in Syria. And I spent weeks in Syria with a good friend of mine, a Russian guy who was in Syria. And I did the Kabbalah show, which is one of the biggest media people who used to be head of NBC in Great Britain, Nigel Kabbalah. And I gave a speech in Damascus Square. And I wish you could pull it up. You could play it, but I guess you can't because it's harder to do it on Rumble.
Yeah, definitely.
But so in Damascus Square, I spoke to 50,000 Syrians, and Memory made a big deal of it. You know, former Klansman speaks in Syria, and what I said to the people of Syria was, "This is before the whole Syrian war and the effort against Syria," and I said to them, I gave a speech, and I said, it hurts my heart to say it. This is 50,000 people. It hurts my heart to say this. But it's not just the Golan Heights of your country that's occupied by these Jewish supremacists. And by the way, I was the first person that popularized the term Jewish supremacism. Now everybody's using it, even Jews, even Bezalel, the leading, even Amnesty International is using the term. I made a book, Jewish Supremacism, which is about Jewish supremacism. I mean, and you're talking about a racism that far eclipses anything white people. In fact, in my life, and I grew up during the opposition civil rights movement, I didn't meet anybody that ran around saying that they were white supremacists, right? Yeah. But Jewish supremacism is real. And I said that I wanted you to understand something. It hurts my heart to say it, but it's not just the Golan Heights that's occupied by these people. And by the way, the whole world recognizes that Jews had no right to take over the Golan Heights. They do it with the excuse that say, well, the Golan Heights are high. We can't have our enemies having high heights. Well, it's their country, right? It's a pretty big part of it. It's almost, it's the one place in Syria where you have skiing, right? And so what, all right? That gives them the right to take over other people's homes, other people's lands, other people's businesses, kick them out of the country if they don't like them, put them in prison, torture them in prison. And there's no greater institutions of torture than what the Jewish state does. According to Bezalel, which is a leading human rights group in Israel, they've tortured hundreds of thousands, at least 200,000 Palestinians, you know, in the original Nakba, 750,000 Palestinians were kicked out. At least 200,000 were tortured. In Israeli prisons. In fact, recently, on Jewish media in Israel, because there's a lot more, if you go to Jewish controlled and owned media in Israel, for Jews in Israel, there's a lot more freedom for you to get the truth there and for Jews to hear the perfidy of Israel than you have for Jewish owned media in America for non-Jews to hear the truth. Right. And that's kind of interesting. It just shows you. And one of the reasons for that is that they consider Jews like the elites. The same thing that a Roman citizen, for instance, in the Roman Empire, or the Greeks, you know, because they were the leaders, they were the elite, they were given certain amounts of rights and freedoms, even if they, you know, they might be opposed by, you know, the people around the country or some of the elite, because they had a certain amount of legality. They could defend themselves in court, but our people are not entitled to that. So anyway, if you look at what's going on, so I got up there and I said, it hurts my heart, but it's not just the Golan Heights that's occupied by these Zionists and Jews. It's Washington, D.C. It's New York. It's London. It's Paris. It's Los Angeles and Hollywood. It's the broadcasting media of the world. It's the elite of American academia. And I pointed out to them, it was a very recent article. I've got a copy of it. You can look this up too. And this is an article from the New York Times, which is, by the way, a Jewish newspaper.
Yep.
There's five Jews, and they identify themselves as Jews. They support the cause. And I can't say everything is a radical Zionist, but the New York Times is very clearly, in fact, practically everybody who's trying to fight for Palestinian rights or keep us out of these wars, and they've been cheerleaders for the wars. The New York Times was basically bought by Adolf Ox in 1895. And this paper promoted the rise of Bolshevism.
Right.
And it promoted the takeover of Russia, which killed tens of millions of people, at least 20 million by the NKVD, and later at least another 10 million, if not more, in Ukraine, for instance, and then countless more Eastern Europeans, and not just Germans. They raped practically every woman from 8 to 80 in a lot of these occupied territories, and it wasn't just Germans. It was also Poles and Latvians and Estonians, which were eliminated. Königsberg, of course, was completely ethnically cleansed. And the guy that was head of the propaganda was Ilya Ehrenberg, similar to the name of...
He made statements about killing all the Germans. That was morally acceptable to rape and kill all the Germans.
When there's peace at the front, don't waste your time. Go kill it. You can still kill a German civilian, right?
Yep, keep killing.
Go rip the babies out of German mothers, right? I mean, and by the way, that's also in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
I would tell those... evangelicals, almost all opposed to abortion, I'd tell them and said, well, what do you think about these Jewish terrorists ripping the innocent babies? And you got to say babies are innocent. And by the way, this goes completely against the teachings of Jesus Christ. You think about it. Because one thing that Christ did, first of all, the New Testament says that everybody, that the golden rule must apply to every people. It's not just... when the Ten Commandments is not supposed to, well, he showed how it did the opposite, but it's not supposed to just be don't kill, a Jew. It's don't, you shouldn't kill anybody. But then you have all these genocides, 64 different genocides in that. Now, again, I don't want Christians to be upset with me. I'm a Christian, but I just want people to understand, if you feel like there's a conflict, and again, we know that the Old Testament didn't get really codified. And this is from Jewish science until about the second century before Christ. Right. And it got codified because they wanted to create the idea that God was a Jew. And that and God was a Jewish supremacist. And if they could teach other people that, well, they're the people of God. And if you go against God, God's a vengeful and a murderous God. And in the Old Testament has sections where it says, where supposedly God commanded them to take the swords and rip the babies out of the bellies of the enemies.
Yeah.
Also to kill men, women, and children. And sometimes they changed that thing a little bit and said, go ahead, kill all the men, and kill all the boys and so forth. But save the wives for yourselves to ravage, to rape.
Yeah.
That's nice, right? And to save all those virgins, the little girls, little boys. And by the way, pedophilia is and this sounds like I'm a terrible hate monger, but there is a lot of pedophilia in the Talmud.
Absolutely.
Where they actually say things like it's okay, and homosexual rape too. They say it's okay to rape, a boy younger than 10 years old. It's okay.
It's disgusting.
It's okay. It's not a big deal. You can rape a boy that's under 10 years. You can rape a boy, that's, you know, a child under two, because, you know, because it's just like putting a finger in the eye. You know, if you do a little girl under the age of, this is sick stuff, but it's really true, under the age of three, that the hymen or the virginity comes back to them and grows back. It's this weird stuff, right? And that sounds really crazy, but people often talk about the Quran. There's a lot more perversion, you know, and truthfully, in the Old Testament. Now, I don't want, again, Christians get upset with me, and I know that Christians will have apology for that, but I just want to point them out that if you really read the New Testament, I've read it twice, straight through twice, once knowing about the Jewish question and once not, and I've studied this New Testament, that the New Testament is a book that's saying Christ is going to fulfill the law by love, by forgiveness, by redemption, by justice, treat everybody fairly and decently. And when you, and so the New Testament says there's no Roman, no Greek. You've all got to be at least treated the same. It didn't say there weren't Romans. It didn't say there were no Greeks. What it really meant by that is that all salvation and these people should be treated like we treat all people, that we shouldn't be going out there to cheat other people, steal from other people, hurt other people. And I realized as a young man that I wanted to preserve our people, our culture. I think we've got a right to live. And I think all people want to do that. And I think basically all people on earth have that fundamental human right to preserve themselves. In fact, the first law of nature, right, is self-preservation. Every species, every single individual life form will fight to save their life and preserve their life and their children and preserve their people. Greece is overwhelmingly Greek, and they want it to remain Greek. Right. Turkey, which is a Muslim country, but it's still Turkish. It's 90% Turkish. They want it to stay 90% Turkish. Right?
Right.
Now, the... When they do this divide and conquer, and the reason why the Jews even exist as they do today is because this is how Adler decides. And Adler is, like I said, one of the chief archaeologists in Israel. He's on the archaeological headboard. He's got a whole book written about, you know, when did Judaism really come out in terms of the Jewish people, Judeans and so-called Israelites. When did they really start practicing the way Judaism is practiced still today, and the way it would start to be practiced in about the first century. And he goes to these places, this hardcore archaeology, so he can look at Jewish houses where this has the Hebrew writing and the Hebrew things on their pottery and the rest of it, Jewish signs here and there, and he can look at how they lived. And for instance, one of the laws, the strict laws of Judaism, is you should not have graven images. And they always talk about Judaism as a monotheistic religion. And the Old Testament says, no other gods before thee. And by the way, that's almost a polytheistic idea. No other gods before, because of the gods, but no other gods before thee. But if you look at Judean coins, which are done by the Judean government, Herod and people, before that time, they especially before that time, they often would have coins with things like Aphrodite, Jewish goddess, on the coin. Right. Totally against the monotheism. Totally, you know, against the idea of graven image. And if you look at what happened after the Torah was more adopted in practice and ritual, Judaism got radicalized. And the reason was, and this is the way this Jewish scholar, I hope I'm not getting too deep in the woods in terms of this philosophy and this Jewish scholarship, but Adler says it this way. The Jews just kept losing. You know, they were conquered by the Persians, they were conquered by the Babylonians, taken in Babylonian captivity. The Egyptians conquered them. In some ways, these other people. And the fact is, even if you read the Old Testament, even if that Old Testament was exactly the way it actually happened historically, Jews came in and killed the areas that they came into were occupied by people, right. Men, women, and children. And it was a good thing to kill them, including get rid of those kids, you know, ethnically cleanse it, right? That's what God wants you to do. Now, Jesus, just to give a small example of the difference between what Christianity teaches and Judaism teaches. Christianity didn't enjoy the lessons and the love and the values of fairness and everything that Jesus taught. In fact, that's why they crucified him. Jesus, it's just really kind of amazing when you think about it, because here's a good example, okay? The New Testament constantly says that the golden rule must apply to everybody. The disciples asked Christ, according to at least the Gospels that we have. And again, it's hard to prove any of these things in terms of historiography. I mean, because we do know what's in those scriptures. And one can read the sayings of Jesus Christ as written in the scriptures, and you get an idea that he believes in love. He believes in forgiveness. He believes in fairness. At least you start out that way. It doesn't mean you can't defend your family. It doesn't mean you're going to let your kids be raped or destroyed. But he did talk about the fact, and he made it clear, that justice and treating people properly is something that you must give to all people, a sense of fairness. Judaism, in its very roots, is basically even things they said were really terrible for Jews, they said it's fine to do to Gentiles. Now, that's not an ethic. It's not ethical. See, look, I want to preserve the white race, and I don't want to exploit anybody. I would have been a big campaigner against bringing black slaves to America. That didn't work out too well for them or for us, right? And even one of my heroes was Robert E. Lee, who was also, he fought in the war because he believed in Southern sovereignty and the right of people to succeed, just like the North succeeded from the British, right? It's the same principle. All the South did is exactly what the Declaration of Independence provides for, right? And he was not about to fight against his own people. He was offered command of the Union Army. But he himself said that slavery was going to end. And he tried to avoid the war. But the Civil War was not truly a civil war. I'm giving you a Southern point of view here. But the Civil War is not a civil war, really. And again, it's a good example of how all the narratives are always changed by the powers that be, because they want to demonize white people. In fact, the Civil War wasn't even fought about slavery. In fact, even Abraham Lincoln himself said, and anybody can verify this historically. Again, I'm an historian, a PhD in it. I studied it. Lincoln said, if I could preserve the Union without freeing a single slave, right? I would have, right? That this was about preserving the Union. That's what he himself said. He also, in his Emancipation Proclamation, the first drafts of it, he said that he suggested recolonizing Africa, freeing the black people, letting them achieve their destiny, and us having a big problem, spend a lot of money doing it, compensate the whites in the South, and help blacks. In fact, they set up a whole country in Liberia, freed slaves. In fact, they ended up being the leader of that country this is hard to believe. Most of the American founding fathers were members of the American Colonization Society. And they weren't that way because they hated blacks or wanted to suppress them. They wanted to free the blacks, slaves. They realized that slavery was not the kind of institution that we weren't around. And I realized in my lifetime that if I really wanted freedom for my people and the right of my people to survive and to live, and to live to our potential, to our identity, because every people should be allowed that, and every people should be allowed to thrive in their own environments as much as possible, that, you know, I would be kind of a big hypocrite if I stood up for white rights and the survival of white people, but didn't recognize that we shouldn't be enslaving other people, or we shouldn't be invading other people's countries. Now, I realize historically there's always been tribes conquering other tribes. it was law of tooth and nail for most of the history of humanity. From the time immemorial, there was just the tribes would raid, carry off all the women, enslave everybody, kill people, rape, plunder, and all that stuff. But we came to an understanding as we evolved and as European values evolved, because Europeans were kind of led this fight. There were some other societies that did as well, not just Europeans, but some others too. But Europeans realized that it really wasn't ethical to, if you don't think it's right for you to be slave, to enslave other peoples. Now, if you want to go do trade with them, if you want to go, you know, make deals with them or whatever, that's fine. But you really don't, and you don't have the right to kill people, torture people, exploit people. Look at the human trafficking that Jews have been famous for instance, the millions of Eastern Europeans. I mean, this is the height of evil. White slavery is slavery. Right. And it's a horrible thing. But anyway, going back to it, I'm sorry to go so wild here, what I'm trying to say is that the ultimate racism on earth. So I'll just give you two examples from the Bible and hope people will understand this, especially my Christian friends. I'm a Christian and I just want them to understand that if there's going to be a conflict, if you think there's any sort of conflict, now many people say there's no conflict between the New and Old Testament. But I can tell you that in some ways, if you actually read the New Testament with an open heart and open mind, you realize that Jesus Christ taught love and forgiveness, kindness, and that laws must apply to everybody. But in the Old Testament, it says that Jews have the right to enslave non-Jews. It says not only do they have the right to do it, it's a good thing to do, right? I mean, it's unbelievable. They have the right to kill whole other peoples, including innocent children, that babies who are innocent should be killed. You know, this is people that don't even live in their own lands. This is other people's lands. Steal their property. Is that in line with the Ten Commandments? Is that in line with thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's life? Wife, when they say, oh yeah, kill all these people, and they say it's a command from God, and also ravage the wives of people, or run swords in the bellies of pregnant women. That's in there.
Yeah.
And not only did the Old Testament say this about non-Jews, which, by the way, are us. I want all of your listeners and the Christians listening to think about it. Non-Jews, Greeks, were a part of our ancestry. And they're clearly in the Bible as Gentiles, non-Jews.
Right.
And Romans were non-Gentiles. In fact, the name Gentile comes from the Roman term gens. That's the original families, the Latin gens. That's where Gentiles comes from, right? So it's really fascinating. So this is what they said. They said, okay, you can enslave non-Jews and you can keep them as your slaves forever. Till the end of time, slavery's fine, right? But for Jews, they said, you can't do that. However, there's always a catch. There's always a technicality. And this is what the Talmud's all about. It's figuring out ways to be corrupt and get around the law, and even do this to your own people. Because the same Old Testament preaches that it's okay to sell your little baby girl into sex slavery and slavery. It's okay to do that. And even though I'm certainly opposed to feminism, and I think feminism has been a way that Jews divide and conquer as well. And they have led that movement. It was all led by Jews. And I understand why Jewish women don't like men, because the prayer that's still used in Jewish Orthodoxy is, thank you, God. This is a daily prayer that millions of Jews do around the world and who are members of the Orthodox Judaism. They say, God, thank you for not making me a goy, not making me a Gentile, not making me a slave, and not making me a woman. Oh, excuse me, woman, slave. So the most important two things is you can't be a woman and you can't be a slave, you know, or whatever. It's crazy. Or you can't be a goy. You didn't weren't a goy and you weren't a woman. Excuse me. And then if being a goy or a woman is worse than being just a slave.
Right.
So it's, and this is real. Now, what Christians have to understand, and I think Jesus understood this, that the New Testament, Jesus says the kingdom will be taken away from you and given to a kingdom worthy of. Now, I'm not telling everybody to be a Christian. I'm a Christian. These are my personal beliefs, and I can't vouch for everything scientifically that's proven. It's just a matter of faith. I'd like to believe, and I choose to believe, that maybe there is life after death, and maybe someday you'll see those loved ones. If you go to Europe, even pagan lands, and the early people of Europe in the caves and settlements of Norway or Denmark or Germany or Italy or these places, they had, when they buried people, they had tombs for the dead. They believed in their heart, they wanted to believe that they came back. They wanted to believe that there was something else after life. And it was a beautiful thing because it helped also people deal with the hardship and the terrible agonies that sometimes life would bring to people in this hard world. So I like to believe that. And I choose to. But I'm not somebody that's going to tell you I can prove it scientifically, right? Even though sometimes people might try to do it. So anyway, here's slavery. That's a pretty example. And then you have something else. Here's another good example. In the Old Testament, usury is roundly condemned. And usury, to make sure that people understand the term usury, people think about that as interest. It actually means exorbitant interest. And it's the same reason why loan sharking is outlawed by just about every other country. It's a serious crime in America, serious crime in every European country, serious crime in almost every nation of the world, loan sharking. Because as Maimonides describes it, as the Bible describes it, Maimonides calls it nezek. It's a Hebrew term meaning biting. And whenever I hear that term, it reminds me when I was a kid. I remember back down south where I lived, we'd go catch turtles a lot. And I remember one of my friends getting a snapping turtle. And that snapping turtle got a hold of this little boy's arm like this. And we had to go to the doctor to get the damn snapping turtle. I'm like, this guy's in agony, right? It's called biting. That's what usury is. And that's what happens. People say, have a crop failure or the house burns down. They got to feed their kids. And then unscrupulous people with money say, I'll lend you money, but you know, it's a 50% interest or 20% interest. In fact, credit cards, some of the credit cards now are 32% interest. I mean, that's usury. And that's these Jewish banks like Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and so forth. So usury is condemned, and it's condemned for a Jew to practice usury to another Jew. But guess what the Bible says? It's okay to do it against the goyim. It's okay if it's a Roman or a Greek, a Canaanite or a Philistine or whatever. That's fine. You can do it against them. Now, that again goes against everything Christ says. So Christ said the main thing is you got to treat everybody kind and you got to treat everybody fairly. And that's a very important law. Now, if we're going to get to the depth of this thing, let's just talk about the massacre of the innocent children. And I believe I don't know what's right or wrong. All I know is that we have no scriptures. We have some fragments, but we have no complete record of the so-called Torah, the Jewish Tanakh, right? That's earlier than about the second century BC. Yet it's supposed to be written by Moses, which was living 1,500 years before that time, at least. But those manuscripts. So if there were manuscripts, they'd have been handed down, copied, right, a million times. And when those things are copied, there's going to be mistakes put into it, I believe, right? So I'm very Christian. I do believe that, especially the New Testament. Now, the New Testament was a little different. The New Testament is much more recent. The New Testament was still written a bit after Christ. In fact, there are very few even authors of the New Testament even knew Jesus Christ, right? Except for people that said they had visions like St. Paul. But the point is that the idea is that, what's the best way to put this, okay? The idea is that I don't have to think that everything in the Bible is the absolute inspired word of God, because we even know the books in the Bible, part of it was decided by the Nicene, the Nicene Council with Constantine. Part of it was decided by the Council of Trent. Some books were let out, some books were let in. A lot of Christian scholars, and these are Christians dedicated to Christ, who believe like some of the epistles of Paul weren't written by Paul. That's just what they say. They say about half of them weren't written by Paul. And they show that the literary tradition is wrong. There's contradictions and all these things. But it doesn't matter to me. I know that when I read the New Testament, especially the words of Christ himself, that I like the values of it. But so what did Christ say about how we treat innocent people? First of all, he said we treat everybody the same in terms of justice. He didn't say, again, that we all have to become Greeks or Romans. Our Greeks or Romans shouldn't have the right to their identity. Our Jews didn't have the right to have their identity. What he said was that we all must stand up and have a morality, that it's not okay for us to cheat other people, steal from other people, murder other people, much less murder their children. And there was no greater crime to Jesus Christ. And again, the New Testament's clear that you can't hurt anybody that's other. And you know what he said about children. And again, Christ viewed all children as of the kingdom of God. I'm not trying to give a sermon here. I'm just trying to explain Jewish racism and supremacism. And so Christ says, okay, he's talking to his disciples in one of the homes. And the kids are kind of making some noise. Little children are making noise. So the disciples say, and these followers say, Lord, do you want us to get the kids out of the room? Jesus says, no, I want, let them come on to me. Let them come to me. And he goes on to say, he said, little children, because of their innocence, and I believe this too. I've had children in my life. I have grandchildren in my life, and a little child is open to the world. There's no hatred in a little child. I mean, they can get upset about certain things, but it's like they're innocent. They come into the world so wide-eyed and bushy-tailed and wanting to love. And if you do something, if you're angry about them, in 5 minutes again, they'll be like Christ. They'll be forgiving you, right? And Christ said that these children belong to the kingdom of God. And he said basically they're believers in me. Now listen to this. He calls out one of the children that he's dealing with in this home. And he says, and he calls out this little girl, I think it was a little girl, and he brings the child to him and he blesses the child. And this is what he says. He said, I want to tell you something, folks. He says, this beautiful child is of the kingdom of God. And he says, anyone, and boy, I believe this. To me, there's no worse crime than pedestry, molesting, harming a kid, or killing a kid, including the Palestinian kids, by the way. And I would say the same thing about somebody killing Jewish kids. But it's like, what did he say? He said, anyone that would so much make a child stumble, it's better off if they have a millstone tied around their neck and dropped to the bottom of the sea. And what he meant by that was, it's better for them. They need to die, but it's better for them because that's a much quicker death. It's better for them if they have a millstone because in society of decent people, they would stone somebody that did that. And stoning or crucifixion or all these other kind of tortures that people do. And somebody who had their child molested or raped, or murdered or hurt, right, would make sure those people did not die a good death. He said it's better for them to have a millstone around their neck. But so if Jesus is God, that's what he said. He said, you look in my face, you're looking in the face of God. If Jesus is God, then Would Jesus really condone the killing of innocent children by the thousands or little girls and allowed and even said in the Bible to take them as booty, as spoils of war, so you can go rape a child? Now, this is common in Hollywood. There's a lot of evidence. There's a big thing right now about Gene Hackman. And he was talking about these elite in Hollywood that they tried to get him into the elite because he was one of the top actors. And if you don't keep the secrets, but they take him to this party where he sees this kind of crap going on. And he said the greatest regret of his life that he didn't stand up and speak about it because he knew it would destroy his life because they would kill him or they would destroy his career. But he felt really guilty because he didn't do anything about it. This is Jewish. You know, a lot of this is the cesspool that Hollywood is. So that's enough of that. We can go on to other things from religion. But it's important to understand that the Jewish religion created the Jewish people. Now let's go to the genetics for a minute, if you like. Where do you want me to go?
Yeah, let's wrap up on genetics, and then we only have about 10 minutes left already. Time flies when you're discussing these topics.
I'm peeping people. I hope I'm not putting people to sleep.
No, I never
have any problem with people. You know, I went to a lot of classes when I was an upperclassman and, you know, in graduate school, and I taught a lot of graduate courses. All my classes were jammed, and I never even ever saw somebody fall asleep in my classes, even though, you know, I would join out a lot. But we got 10 minutes. So let's talk about genetic for a second. That's something you talked about. I don't believe that all Jews are genetically necessarily evil or they have all Jews have an evil gene. But I do believe there's certain tendencies, psychological. We know now, for instance, the Bouchard studies in Minnesota where they studied children. And they know who the parents are, but these were identical twins. They have exactly the same genetics. They were divided at birth, and that's happened to a lot of poor people. They're divided at birth, and one child went to one family, some of them halfway around the world. Like some were raised in whatever, Japan or, you know, some European country. And they found out that the personalities of these kids were more like the children of their birth, their mother and father, because they did genetic testing. They tracked them down. Bouchard at the University of Minnesota tracked them down. And so they did all these psychological surveys. Now, these people didn't even know where their kids were. You know, they gave up the kids for adoption. They do psychological studies, and they found like 40% of their attitudes, whether they were conservative or liberal, whether they were very aggressive or very passive in their idea. It was so amazing. They find identical twins, right? They live halfway around the world. And both twins bought a house with a big tree in the backyard and both built a circle of friends around it. You know, that both twins had a habit of flushing the toilet before using it. But, I mean, it's really weird how some of this stuff is patterned. And so I think there are certain tendencies. Now, one of the things they used to test for was ethnocentrism. And we know that ethnocentric tendencies are very, very I have a hereditary component. Now, what is it about Judaism that would lend itself to that? And what about Judaism makes Jews? So let's just say, first of all, let's say, what is the ideology of Judaism? If you look at it as a political ideology, Judaism is like the most radical form of Nazism you could imagine. And this is what some people like Roger Waters are saying, many other Jews are saying this. They're saying these Jews in Israel are more Nazis than how Jews who hate Nazis and write the most vile description of Nazis in Hollywood movies, the most evil people ever, Jews are more resembling them than they even resemble the Germans. Because the Germans during the war, they would never put out something to the German people because they knew the German people had a different ethic. They were preaching an ethic that you're kind to children, that anybody that would kill a child is vile. One of the things that the National Socialists had against the Jews was the Weimar Republic, which the Jews controlled the culture just like they control it in this country. They're LGBTQ, and they promote homosexuality. And more little boys have been molested. It's almost unimaginable historically by homosexuals than any party, much more than heterosexuals, by the way. And one in six boys are facing this kind of horror. And even the Greeks wrote about this in their own novels. So it's like if you really look at what's going on, I'll tell you that I always say things that shock followers. And whatever you think of the Germans, I always say this. I say, you know, there is still an enormous Nazi threat to the world. But it's not from National Socialists. It's not from the people who were basically nationalists in Germany, who wanted their banking system not to be exploitive, not with interest. They didn't want the trafficking of children as it was in the Weimar Republic. And what's gone on in Eastern Europe, right, for instance, the last few decades. Massive millions of Eastern European Slavs and so forth, corrupted and put into these international rings. And they were run from Israel, by the way. In fact, as is said, Israel is promised land for pedophiles. And it really is, actually.
Yeah.
And so this is what National Socialists were about. But no National Socialist would ever get up and publicly say, we got to go kill Jewish babies.
Of course.
Now, you can argue that they did or they didn't, whatever, but no Jew would. Now, the interesting thing is Jews argue this all the time. In fact, one of the things they say every day is that, and this is their excuse for doing what they're doing in Palestine, they'll say, we killed those Nazi babies, didn't we? That was justified. Was it really? 800,000 German women and children burned alive in the cities? And this was a bombing campaign that was sponsored by the Jews. There's a book called Germany Must Perish, which was written by Theodor Kaufmann, a Jewish radical, racist, ultra-racist Jew. And in this book, the first page of the book says, a comprehensive program for the extermination of all of the German people and the destruction of Germany and the dissection of Germany, right, and the proportionment of its lands. And the interesting thing is this book was written and it was reviewed by the leading publications in the United States. The two most important papers in the United States at that time was the New York Times and the Washington Post. The Washington Post was bought by Eugene Meyer, the Meyer family, Jews, and it was also interventionists that wanted the war. And the same thing with the New York Times. They reviewed the book where this guy called for the mass murder, for the genocide of all the Germans. That's 60 million, at least 65, 70 million Germans. And guess what the New York Times and the Washington Post called it? An idea's time has come. A plan for permanent peace among the nations.
Yeah.
Now, there's something wrong with this picture, right? Now, the Germans would have never said such a thing. You know why? Because they taught an ethic for their own people that would be, they would look at something like that with horror. Horror that if the Germans were saying we should kill Jewish babies.
Of course.
And this is so important that Nietzsche said it really well. When we look at this Jewish communists and the mass murders that they were, and we look at some of the evil in our society, Nietzsche said it very well when he said, you got to be careful. When you look into the evil in the abyss, be careful because it's looking back at you. You can't become what you're saying. And those of our people that support the preservation of our European people, our survival, our fundamental rights of life and liberty and freedom, if you really believe in that, you're not helping our cause one iota by saying, oh, we got to kill the Jews or our enslaved black people, even if, however you mean it, even if it's supposed to be for theater, it doesn't do any good. In fact, Jews will use that to prove that we're the evil ones, even though this is a reaction to the way the Jews do.
Right.
And everything that we see, it's almost like we live in a false reality. We do live in a false reality. I'll give an example. Everybody's seen October 7th. And you ask people every day, I do this every time I get into a discussion or a debate with people about October 7th. And I ask them, I said, well, how many Jewish kids died on October 7th? There were 1,200 people that died. And there's evidence that 400 or 500 of them died from friendly fire, the Hannibal directive, right? But I ask them, how many Jewish kids died? Nobody can answer the question. I started looking it up early on after October 7th, and I found out that, you know, I would say, how many Jews died on October 7th, Jewish children? And they never came up with the answer till much later. They always come up, well, we have these thousands of Palestinians that died since then, right? But that was also limited to the number that it really was. But the point is that they didn't want people to understand that, because 36 children out of 1,150 or so, which I think the numbers are, that's maybe 4% or so, or less than 4%,
right,
of children that died. So if less than 4%, 36 children died before October 7, and just in just three or four different Jewish incursions in the Gaza, with dropping giant bombs, tank shells, artillery, killing, and three quarters of those dead were women and children. 40% of them were children. 40%, not 4%. 40%, not 36 children, but you can see in just in the 15 years before that, and repeated Jewish incursions into Gaza and the West Bank, and there's a lot of killed in the West Bank all the time by settlers, and they get away scot-free. But if you see that, it's not 36 children that died in that concentration camp called Gaza, which even Jewish leaders called a concentration camp, the biggest concentration camp on earth, they called it.
Yeah.
But if you look at that, okay, it's not 36 children. It's maybe 3,600 children. So if whatever children died makes the Gazans to be monsters and animals and deserves to kill all the people of Gaza, what is Jews before October 7th killing 3,500 children?
Right. It's certainly a hell of a lot worse. So I hate to cut you, because we are going to have to wrap up. We're coming up on the last three minutes here.
Okay, I'll wrap it up then with a couple sentences. And the sentence is this, that the truth is, and this is something we've got to talk about, not today any longer, but we got to talk about the fact every time we have the chance of it. The ultimate supremacism, the ultimate, it's not white supremacism that rules this world. It's Jewish supremacism. And they not only killed millions, 100 million people under communism. In fact, that's including the resolution before the United States Congress. I'm very familiar with that. And it's 100 million people killed by communists. Communists was a Jewish movement. Even Winston Churchill says it. And it's not just that. There's so much evidence of a Jewish paramount role. And in the First World War, which killed 37 million or 40 million, it varies, and the Second World War, which killed between 60 and 80 million, that's over 100 million people, okay? 100 million people. This war, which is just like Kaufman, Jews were trying to create this war because they saw Hitler's Germany, and there's no evidence that Germans were ever trying to conquer the world, not even trying to conquer Europe. They didn't even want war with England and France. They were declared war upon because they said that the German city of Danzig should be able to vote democratically, which they did vote, to rule their own, themselves. So everything is like turned upside down in this world. And the Gaza thing, the thing with the children, the thing with even the hostages. Every day we heard about the 250 hostages. Well, before October 7 happened, there were 10,000 hostages, prisoners, being often raped. They even raped men and young boys. 40% of the children, according to Save the Children, had suffered molestation and rape in Israeli prisons.
Yeah,
this didn't happen to the Gazans, or to the Israelis held by the Gazans. In fact, when those prisoners were released the other day, just about every one of them said they were treated great. And they came back. They didn't come back with damage to their insides and all that from being raped by rifle barrels. But right. So this is the reality. We are people that are not promoting slavery or destruction. I am the opposite of a racist. A racist is defined by the lexicon of the times as a person who hates others, wants to suppress them, even destroy whole races. I believe in the right of every people to be able to preserve themselves, including my own. And because I'm consistent on this and not a hypocrite, I think I have every justification to saying, just like people, the left, for instance, wants to say, yes, Palestinians should be able to live in their own country. They shouldn't be having their homes stolen from. They shouldn't be tortured in the prisons. They shouldn't be mass murdered. There shouldn't be genocide. And we have a right to live in Europe and a right to live in America. Things happened hundreds of years ago. They've happened to all peoples. And Europe has been invaded just like America or Europe has invaded others. But the point is, we have a new ethic today, and we have to be consistent, and we cannot let the Jews, we cannot let the abyss that we stare at, the evil that we stare at when we look at Jewish supremacism, we can't let them turn us into that. Because yeah. What's beautiful about the West and our people is the art, the beauty, the literature, the architecture, the human rights involved in. That is the greatness of what our people are. So absolutely. We have to fight the evil, but at the same time, we cannot become like they are.
Very
and
good.
If we do that, I think you can. I think this, if you get people, if you get this to get our kids, when they talk to their friends and they talk to their parents and say, well, I believe in human rights. You can define white rights as human rights because that's what it is. The right of all people to preserve their heritage, the will of self-preservation, and their freedoms and their rights, not facing discrimination, not facing a hate media. That's the real hate media, and that is the propaganda of the controlled media, right? So if you can tell them that, and you speak to them and you say, when you approach other parents, when you talk to their friends, and their friends tell them about what you said, or when they go to school and they use this argument, it's an irrefutable argument.
Yeah.
That's how we change the world.
Well, Duke, we're
use the lexicon of the times.
We're a little over 6 o'clock. I got to close out because I do have somebody coming on right after for the next time slot. But for the audience that was listening in, if you guys want to hear more from David Duke, because he's got very much to spread, a lot of information. You're a wealth of knowledge. You can catch him. He does a show with Dave Gahary called The David Duke Show on ftjmedia.com. You guys can catch him there. And I just want to say thank you, Duke, for coming on. This was a pleasure to hear some of your very great thoughts. You're very educated on these subjects.
I'll get a little more laid back next time, but let's do it again next week if you want.
Okay, Duke. I'll tell you what. I'll call you up, and we'll get something else scheduled.
I appreciate your work. I think you're a rising star in this movement, and I think what you're doing is you're probably dedicating your life to this effort. And what greater thing could someone like yourself, a young man, you make me think of myself at your age, right? That what greater purpose could you have than saving the highest ideals of Western civilization and of our people and the preservation and all people, really? Because I do believe unless we solve this problem, confront this problem, and overthrow this Jewish supremacism, not only will the white race go down, but humanity will go down. This world will go down. Yeah. That's really what we're talking about, an existential crisis right now. So I salute you, and I urge all your listeners and your followers on whatever network you're watching, or YouTube or Twitter or whatever, support this man, support your work, support Dave Gahary. Go to my show at rinseradio.com, and you can also go to davidduke.com. You can also get my book, Jewish Supremacism, which is, other than the protocols, it's the most read book in the world on Jewish supremacism. And that's a book by that title. And yet now I created that terminology, and now it's the most normal word to describe Jewish ultra-racism. So you can get that book through Dave Gahary. And these are signed copies, and he charges a little premium, but they're taking some of that money to help, you know, finance my cancer treatment and my work. So anyway, you can do that at the Dave Gahary and Money Tree Publishing as well, and at FTJ.
All right. Thank you again, Duke, and thank you for all of your efforts all the way up until your age and continuing forward. It's very great to see.
I didn't even get, like, a tenth of my biography, the interesting lectures that I got involved in. The debates. I've been on Meet the Press 3 times. It's really crazy.
We'll certainly touch on that another time. But with that said, thank you to everybody for listening, and we'll see you guys. We'll do a show again in the future for sure. Thank you, folks.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.